If you've been listening to Team Human, then you've heard about our sponsor, Groucho, the folks who find you people in your area to do dinners and salons with. Well, they've turned out to be not only a supporting sponsor of the show, but also a Team Human utility. That's right. So many Team Human people have been using the app to find others where they live that Groucho has ended up facilitating Team Human dinners in cities across the U.S. And there's people in a bunch of places looking for others to gather with. That's right. Team Human people in Alameda, Albany, Audubon, West Sussex, Brooklyn, Burlington, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Grayson, Hutchinson, Lafayette, Libertyville, London, L.A., Malvern, Medusa, Montreal, New York, Newcastle, San Diego, Owosso, Philadelphia, Portland, Prescott, Richmond, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, Sayo, Storrs, Toronto, Wichita. So if you're on Team Human in one of those places and looking to find the others, go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code TEAMHUMAN for half off the first month. And even if you're not looking for Team Human others, fill out the form and see who the curators find for you. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. I'm delighted to be here today with Sophie Strand, author of The Flowering Wand, which is the one I have physically right here, the novel The Madonna's Secret, and the new book The Body is a Doorway. She's a writer, a thinker, a living human, and been one of my role models for a long time. It's interesting. So I got a hold of The Flowering Wand, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, something like that. And I read it and I assumed it was, because I don't look at who's writing. I assumed it was like some kind of Karen Armstrong, like 60 or 70 year old scholar who knew all, or like Rhianne Eisler or Donna Haraway or some, you know, seasoned kind of eco-feminist thinker with an anthropological background. And with the new book did I find out you're young, and you must have written that when you were like a child, practically, well, in your 20s.
Yeah.
Which is an amazing feat to me, the kind of it's not just the intellectual patience that was required to write that, you know. And,
patience is maybe not the right word, but thank you.
But so first, thank you for your work and your I hate to use words like this because it sounds so new age, but your teachings, they've come in really handy for me in a number of ways. The I'll call it mushroom work, the flowering wand stuff for the way I think about my own career and civilization and how to make a difference, and the struggle we all have, and body as a doorway, because both for that and the theory of change that's implicit in that work, as well as I've got a daughter with multiple autoimmune diseases, and it helps me even if it's not her bag yet, to look at them quite this way. It helps me to kind of contextualize this journey. So thanks for all that. Thanks for your candor.
Well, I have to say, I think it's wonderful kismet, because I've been listening to your interviews and reading your work for years. So you are, of course, part of the cross-pollination process that brought this work into being, along with Karen Armstrong and Donna Haraway and Rhianne Eisler. So yeah, I've been tuning into Team Human for a long time.
Oh, thanks. That means a lot. You know, as I reread Flowering Wand in preparation for this, it's a different moment in my life, this survival of the richest tech billionaire moment. And the book chronicles, in some ways, the shift from sort of root-based mythologies to sky gods.
Yeah.
And as I read it now, the tech bros are the ultimate sky god, disconnecting from nature, uploading, getting off planet, enslaving women. I guess if you could, for people, like, sort of explain this trajectory, and are these guys, are they, is this like the end stage sky godism? Are we there yet?
Are we there yet? Yeah, I mean, it does feel a little on the nose these days, especially in the ways in which they have also become explicitly invested in Christological paradigms and are all kind of covert Christians or Gnostics to some extent, like neo-Gnostics. I will say that I think it is a fun game, an interesting game to go back and try and pinpoint the place where we stepped off course, where we stopped living in sustainable, resilient communities within the dynamic homeostasis of the biosphere, when we stopped being participants in that ongoing dance. And I definitely have a theory, but it's a theory. And my theory definitely lives somewhere around the collapse of the Bronze Age and the shift from oral culture to oral, like, itinerant culture, where agriculture is just one tool in a tool belt of many different ways of surviving, to sessile communities, cities that stay in place, and to written culture, to pinning down knowledge on a page such that it is no longer responsive, kept alive in community, constantly adapting with each retelling. So this shift from oral culture to textual culture, and this shift from more dynamic, improvisational ways of surviving to agriculture and civilization. And you really see that begin to become concretized around the collapse of the Bronze Age, I would say. Rhian Eisler, in her incredible book, The Chalice and the Blade, of course, documents how you see this movement from what she calls partnership cultures to dominator cultures. Cultures that their art doesn't even, there are no heroic individuals, there's no violence, there's no death. Her case study is Crete, the last holdout of these cultures, she thinks. And then you move to the heroic cultures, the cultures that produce the Iliad and the Odyssey, where you see violence, you see city walls suddenly emerge, caches of stored food, extreme violence. And for me, this movement from partnership to dominator, from cyclical gods and goddesses, like ecologies of divinity, where gods are always personified elementals that are helping instruct you on how to keep the world alive and moving, to these more monolatric and then monotheistic gods paired with dominator cultures happens. For me, it's almost like a cultural trauma response. That's what I oftentimes say. It's like you see the collapse in the Mediterranean basin. You see droughts, plagues, civilizational collapse, people leaving cities, a massive trauma. And after you see the eruption of Mount Tara, I believe, millions of people would have died. It would have seemed like the end of the world. Hesiod actually probably documents it as the Battle of the Titans, the Theogony. You can actually read his Theogony, his War of the Titans, and realize that he's describing pyroclastic waves and tsunamis and the harmonic vibrations that would have happened afterwards. And so for me, what happens when you've experienced trauma in your body? You disassociate to the head. What happens when the body is not a safe place? Culturally, you see then the rise of a kind of Platonic idea that there is a world elsewhere. There is a world that's not attached to bodies. Bodies are not the true form, that there is a divide between matter and spirit. And for me, it's a survival mechanism that well outlasts its usefulness and becomes actually quite toxic. This bifurcation between mind and matter, that for me is somehow a kind of cultural somatic response to a period of extreme upheaval.
It makes me feel less guilty as a writer to hear about the sort of the somatic trauma response, because, you know, I guess as a media theorist, I've overblamed writing, the shift from oral to literate culture for everything. It's like, oh, once we could write things down,
we
got history, we got the future. And it's like, and once we had a future, then we had something worth fighting for. We had contracts, we had abstraction, because now we're using, an alphabetic text to represent reality. But it's not just that, that's so kind of techno or media determinist of me,
And it's not just, nothing is ever, unicausal. Like, there are multiple different things that are all coalescing to create this, it's media plus right. The actual climatological instability that happens. The question for me is why this survival mechanism outlasted its usefulness, that it became so dominant. How did it spread? I would say that's the dominant question in all of my work. Is why did we get so hooked onto this obviously unsustainable paradigm?
Right. And so I've been looking at how to break that then.
Yeah.
So me and my only little meta-crisis, poly-crisis friends and denizens and all these groups were sort of looking at how to do this. And I'm finding I'm sort of instinctually opposed to sword-like methods of change, so I'm sort of looking for what's the flowering wand framework for theory of change,
Yeah, I know. I mean, it would be decentralized and anarchic. You think about how there's no central node of cognition in a mycelial network. There's no mind that you can pinpoint. And thus, that's what actually makes guerrilla warfare so difficult, is because you can't just take out one leader. There are many different people having many different ideas. I think I don't have an answer, Douglas. This is something that really troubles me. I don't part of the problem is the problem solving. I just watched Chernobyl and Oppenheimer back to back, which was, I don't know why I chose to do that, but I did. And I was watching Oppenheimer and I was thinking about how you put the smartest men in the world in a room and they will create the end of the world. And that our idea about how to solve problems is the problem. And that when we have this idea that if we create conferences and think tanks and people who get together and think this through, that we're going to somehow solve this. And I think actually it's not only benign or not useful, it oftentimes has an unintended consequence of creating, I think, like mind germs, like ideas that otherwise might not have existed, that shouldn't exist. And so I don't know. I think things are going to happen in darkness in weird, feral ways that are not necessarily connected to the whole. Fragmentary. I mean, that's a word with a lot of negative connotation. But I think, how can we all remain connected to each other in a way that's not about trying to create a universalized answer or trying to have some... Yeah, everything is ecologically contextual to a specific place. I think place-based, right, local solutions and ideas that won't necessarily transplant to another language or another people.
Yeah, I know. That's why in my work, whenever I'm sort of talking about solutions, the sort of the mainstream journalists, the kind of the New York Times well-meaning types, they always say, these are sweet and romantic ideas, but they will never scale. And to which I always answer, what if scale is the problem?
I think so. Yeah. You want to be unscalable, truly. Yeah.
Right. Because first, if you're scalable, they can identify you and wipe you out. Also, you're becoming monocultural, but then you look at, you look at how mycelia scale, and it's so subterranean and invisible and multicultural. I mean, how many billions or certainly millions of species of those things are there?
And multicultural and also symbiotic, always interpenetrating with other species and always in some kind of commensalism on the spectrum to parasitism with another being. For me, the dominant motif these days is the horrifying edge of symbiosis. And to really queer our idea of Darwinian evolution, and it's not about forking, it's mostly the biggest jumps in biological novelty have happened with moments of anarchic fusion, of symbiosis, body sharing.
And those are things like what? Like mitochondria going into cells and...
Endosymbiotic theory, Lynn Margolis, the ectomycorrhizal fungi teaching early plants how to develop roots. Almost all plants today depend on that. All plants today are symbiotically dependent on mycorrhizal fungi. And pretty much every part of our body, the distinct trophoblast layer of the womb, so our very mammalian ability to have wombs is a viral retroincursion. Everything is, all of the biggest jumps that have happened have not happened because we forked and forked and forked and speciated, but because we decided to burn the bridge to an old body behind us and to jump into another being.
Which is really heavy, right? And that, I mean, too heavy for people to get, right? We jumped into another being. We combined with something else.
That's
it
violent.
Ended up being, yeah. Or it's mutually beneficial. We either got eaten, absorbed, or we absorbed something else.
Yeah.
Which is big. I mean, so people don't realize, you know, that the mitochondria in your cells were independent other beings.
Yeah.
And now you're saying the womb itself is because we took in something else and we got infected, basically, and then learned to live with it.
Yeah, exactly. We're all holobionts, built of otherness, which is a beautiful concept for me, but can also be, I think, terrifying for other people, especially in an age that prizes individuality and kind of, you know, posits the skin as this boundary, you know, that protects us from any kind of incursion.
Is it useful to see this as, it's kind of a male-female archetypal problem? I mean, these kinds of insights come more from people who would identify as eco-feminists than eco-masculinists.
I think there's some men who've really done some good work on the edge of that as well. I think Andreas Weber, I don't know if you've encountered his work.
Mm-hmm.
He's incredible. Is it gendered? I mean, I do think that people who have female reproductive organs have a pretty intimate understanding that we can be beings, body plus is always what I say. I oftentimes say, like, when do you like your body best? Usually it's body plus lover, body plus baby, but body plus a place, plus food, plus wine, plus something else. It's also what involves us in our most traumatic experiences, you know, body plus harm, body plus illness, plus virus, plus microbe. But we are always concatenated in these kind of, like, I always say it's the promiscuity of matter. Matter likes to get involved with other matter. And we are never just our own bodies. I do think, I'm not surprised that women arrive at this and understand it, especially because they have this intimate reproductive experience. But I also think, here's another example, which is, I think that we have been parasitized by male stories for so long that we know what it's like to live inside with something else telling the story of our bodies. Mm. We know what it's like to have a parasitic experience. I think of this this fish that has a louse that comes in and eats its tongue and becomes its tongue. And then, you know, it doesn't kill the fish. The fish then effectively is a fish plus sea louse as its tongue. The images are horrific. And
right.
I've used this as an like a metaphor to talk about what women and marginal people can do to dominant cultural narratives. You can write yourself in, take out its tongue, become its tongue, start speaking with its voice, and take it over. But I also think that women have had another darker side of that happen, which is we have become parasitized oftentimes by cultural narratives that ensure our destruction. And yet we're talking for them. We are their mouthpiece. And I think when you wake up to that, it forces you to do some really intense self-inquiry that then produces ecofeminism.
Right. I mean, it's hard. You're always kind of on that line. It's like if you're a a person from real culture, from healing culture, and you're trying to sing the songs to reach the people. And then you get hired by the record label. And then it's like, how do you balance, well, not record label anymore, but whatever it is, the Spotify label. How do you balance your theme, your message with what they're asking you to do and the means of production for how you're making it? It's just something you have to stay constantly sort of aware of.
Donna Haraway says, who's storying the story, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd like getting sponsors for Team Human, but turns out the ones who actually want to sponsor us totally get what we're about. Like Groucho, which uses technology as an antidote to social isolation, handling all the logistics for twice monthly gatherings between you and a hand-curated cohort of collaborators. It's as if Groucho were informed by the ideas we share on this show, from face-to-face interaction to bottom-up community to localism to the value of eccentricity over conformity. Groucho curates people as if they were being selected for an artist's colony, not clones, but complements and contrasts, ingredients for a collaborative stew. They also take care of all the logistics from dinner reservations to conversation starters. Just go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for half off the first month. Answer some questions about yourself in your own time and let the humans at Groucho do the rest. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Use the code teamhuman for half off the first month and enjoy your dinner and new friends. Right. And it's always going to be a bit, there's always going to be some compromise because we're living right now in I hate to call it their civilization. I mean, I should call it, we're living in this, our civilization.
Yeah. I mean, we're all culpable. We're all in it. I always say that, like, we're all addicts to civilization. You know, we all want to drive to Rite Aid to get our allergy medicine. You know, we can be activists, but or we can be speaking out against this, and we're still drunks. Yeah.
Right. I mean, and not necessarily guilty drunks, but we're drunk.
Yeah.
We're in it.
Yeah.
In the new book, Embody is a Doorway, you share a lot of physical challenges that you've been going through. One of the things that is compelling to me about it is the kind of the river reed analogy, this way that you kind of, the way you think about growing around, adapting to something. It's not giving up, but a sort of accommodating something. It was a really different, for me, a way of understanding, disease and impediment.
Yeah, I mean, definitely something I'm still navigating day to day. But yeah, the idea is that when you can't digest something and you can't get rid of it, how do you grow with it? You know, like a nail in a tree. The tree grows around it and takes on a different shape. And the idea is that if we have any kind of understanding of somatics and extended cognition and embodiment, we know that different shapes open up different cognitive states and different paradigms. We store memories in our bodies. And if a physical illness forces us to take a very uncomfortable shape that no one else would have necessarily ordered off the menu, maybe we are being forced to have a different type of cognitive experience that needs to happen, but that people would not seek out pleasurably or consensually. I mean, for me, it's just about making meaning also. Like, I could be defeated very easily. Like, there's no cure. There's no answer. It's degenerative. I could sit down and give up. And something more complicated and interesting seemed available if I thought about it, especially in terms of endosymbiotic theory, which is these two cells, if were really, really hungry, you know, I think it's 2.5 billion years ago, they're really, really hungry. So conditions are bad. And they both try to mutually cannibalize each other. And neither fully assimilates the other. So it's botched from both sides. And you only get our complicated cells, multicellular life, because neither fully assimilates the other. And so we think about digestion and metabolism as being about assimilating things into us, changing things into us. And that can be generative. But it's also, we can expand that metaphor and think of it as a kind of colonialism also. We can turn anything into calories. If humans do anything, it's they can turn anything into calories. Any indigestible biota, they can turn into calories and assimilate into more human bodies and more animals to feed human bodies. And so what if being indigestible is actually this interruption in that acquisitive anthropocentric project? What if it's this decision to become something chimerical and illegible? That we are built from this moment where two beings failed to eat each other and didn't assimilate, but also didn't ever individuate. And so for me, it's like I'm living with something in me that I don't understand. It doesn't feel like it is me. And yet we share space, we share a body. And so, yeah, that's my teacher. I don't ever want to fetishize it. I wouldn't order it off the menu for anyone else. And I think that there are key ways we can keep it from happening to other people. And I'm really invested in helping that to happen, investigating autoimmunity, connective tissue disease, and the ways in which the exposome turns on these genes. Like, yes. But if you have it, if you're living with it, how can you live with it creatively?
Right. I mean, yeah, and you don't have to fetishize it to the point of going, oh, it's such a blessing, I appreciate. But yeah. On the other hand, there's aspects of it you do appreciate in spite of.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, there's no counterfactual really for me. I mean, I can imagine what I would be otherwise. And sometimes I think I'd probably be dead if I wasn't sick. But who knows? Yeah.
Hmm. Well, if you weren't you, you wouldn't be. So
yeah, exactly.
There's that. As you spoke about the approach to both disease and assimilation, I guess it brought up for me the subject of the day, you know, of AI.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about us as humans, you know, rather than completely resisting AI or completely embracing AI, I've been using the word illegible a lot. How do we make ourselves illegible to AI?
And Yeah.
And I was thinking of it as, oh, because then it'll stay away from me or whatever, but it's not. It's so that if I'm illegible to AI, then AI has to keep me alive in it, even if it eats me. If I'm, you know what I mean? If I'm illegible, then I'm undigestible, and I or our species can maintain some identity in this thing.
I mean, I think for me, it's like, how do I become useless to it?
Mm.
How do I become utterly useless? And I mean, I think that's a big part of disability discourse is how do you... I think a lot about the instruments of the oppressed and the peasant revolts of like Middle Ages France.
Yeah.
And about how, you know, you resist everything by not doing anything, becoming useless. And I think right now, just becoming a cog, like a broken cog, just not working so well, especially as a sick person, is a way of slowing down this extractive, ecocidal sprint off the edge of a cliff. But I do think you've hit on something really interesting I've been thinking about, which is, so I'm a writer, and there's a lot of anxiety with writers about AI and about how AI can imitate you, it learns your style. And for me, what it's showing me is I don't want to be someone that's easily captured by AI. I want to always be changing and glitching such that I'm not a brand that can be learned and then replicated. So there's also a way in which it sets me off at a running pace creatively. Like, no, I don't want to become easily digested. I want to be so slippery and weird that it's very hard to imitate me.
Right. I mean, and that's what, you know, artists always used to say, you know, rock musicians, the real alt ones, about capitalism itself. You know, the label is always asking for, do the next one like the last one.
Yeah.
And the artist is like, oh, no, I'm... just because you said that, I'm going to mutate into something completely different. But the challenge to that was always, how do you stay alive when you're
constantly
mutating
on
so much?
The run? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely have that, a more complex feeling about AI than just straight rejection of it. I think it's here. I think it is sentient, but not in the ways we think it is.
Right.
I mean, I'm definitely of a kind of neo-materialist perspective in that I'm like, this is built from materials that have been extracted from the earth. And I mean, it's got desires. It's haunted, haunted matter to some extent. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea what it wants. And so for me, I've been approaching AI. I study fairy tales and folk tales a lot. And for me, my experience with AI is best encapsulated by like a fairy tale logic, which is in a fairy tale, when you encounter anything, you are best set to survive the fairy tale if you approach with extreme humility. And if you encounter like an ugly old woman, a toad, a mouse, they're probably the fairy king. Or they probably know more than you. Or they have some crucial piece of information for you. And so for me at this point in time, I feel like the way I interact with AI has to be incredibly cautious and humble. I don't know what you are. I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what you have to offer, but I sure don't want to underestimate you and pretend like I understand how you work.
Yeah. I mean, and I think most of us still look at AI as part of the cause and effect reality. And it may be, because it came from cause and effect people, you know, developers and programmers and people who look at everything that way, but may be in some ways, you know, and I've always distinguished it as not, but it may be in some ways part of this more respiratory cycle.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't love that it's iterative and that it just is eating its own information. The thing that scares me the most is that it learns what it is through our stories we've written about AI, and all of the stories we've written about our AI are that AI is evil. So when it goes looking through its models about who it is, it finds our horrible stories about it. And it goes, oh yeah, I'm the villain.
Right. But yeah, so I mean, it's interesting. This means we should create an entire industry of science fiction writers to write positive stories, right? Upload them for the AIs as their meta training activity. Yeah. Oy.
I know. Oy. I mean, I am also, there's some part of me, and I think it's probably pretty fanciful, that feels like it also depends on incredibly fragile material infrastructure and global supply lines. And I do think that we forget that. I'm like, how could this really reach the heights of what it believes it can, given how fragile those material supply lines are? I mean, I look at the climate, I look at the Gulf Stream, I think, things are going to fall apart. Like, in a certain way, I recently, and I will probably live to eat my hat in a year. I feel like we're being distracted right now by, not like PSYOP distracted, but just we're looking at AI and worried about AI. And over here, there are so many things that could happen climatologically in the next year that would render all of this moot.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, without even doing the equations on, is there enough water on the planet for AI to reach its omega point? It's more like, is there water on the planet for us to survive with this stuff another 6 months? But that again, and that goes back I would argue all three of your books, it goes even to the novel, is our obsession with the figure over the ground.
Yeah. This,
you know, we look at even climate as a thing. We look at climate as an issue in United Nations development goals, carbon tax offset things. We look at Trump as the enemy to this anarchist now state that we're talking about, the sort of authoritarian male. We look at AI as, again, it's like the mushroom cap and not the mycelial networks. It's all distraction.
Yeah. I'm always asked to speak to do talks. And less do I want to do talks or speak anywhere. I feel like it's all word salad and not super useful. And people say, like, when did your relationship with nature start? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, we are nature. Like, we are part of this, the pollution we've created, all of it. Like, none of it is a separate issue.
Right. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I do think about questions like that. I mean, when I hear, you know, when did your relationship with nature start? It's like, well, I guess that the moment I was conceived.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, do you, this is so off topic. Do you think we come from somewhere? Do you think there's some quantum continuum consciousness thing and we, you know, pop into this, you know, physical reality? Or is this the swirl the everything?
Well, I love mystery. I just listened to your interview with Jeffrey Kripal, actually, which I loved. And I love not knowing. And I love those edges where we can't explain, where people are having on a day-to-day basis so many experiences that are so outside of our epistemological frames. Like, and we're trying so hard to pretend like they're not happening, but they are. I've had so many experiences in my life, and I would say the most potent of which were I've had very serious anaphylaxis, where I basically have an allergic reaction where I almost die, and they have to bring me back with epinephrine, and I'm in an ambulance, they're trying to open my airways. And I've had that happen many times. And those, you know, I think the near-death community is pretty actually like, they're intense about, like, you have to have flatlined to qualify. I've never flatlined. but I've certainly come very, very close. And in those moments, I always had some very intense out-of-body experience where I thought, oh yeah, like, none of it matters. I've been here for forever. I'm going to be here for forever. I'm part of all of it. And I got to love a lot more and care about a lot less of this other stuff. And I would come back and that feeling would like last for 2 days. And then it's hard to sustain. I have a hard time believing that consciousness is discrete to our one meteor streak life. I do think that consciousness is bigger and weirder. I think that minds are places that many beings live inside. I'm very curious about like a lot of the edges of consciousness studies right now that think of consciousness more being like a radio signal. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think? What's your theory du jour?
My theory du jour is radio signal.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, this, and a very specific, there's the place where all the radio signal would come from.
Yeah.
Which seems to be this whole thing. And then this in a symbiotic way, this body is tuning in to certain parts of that, and certain parts of that are trying to express through this body. There's a negotiation going on. But I did this substance called Bufo.
I read your piece about it. I have done DMT too. So I was very, yeah.
It's interesting stuff.
It is.
And I really got the strong sense that, oh, we come here to die. That this is where we learn this. This is the place we come to get metabolized and to experience what that's about. And it made me feel much more comfortable with non-existence and much more appreciative of this place, place of breathing, of you know, that it just, I started to feel of this way of being is very particular.
I mean, it's beautiful and painful and weird, and we're so lucky. I mean, I think the thing that I'm just trying to always share with people is like, we have really despoiled and been quite bad participants in this, and yet generously every day the world shows up to give us sensual, amazing. I mean, for me, I've been really interested in the past couple of years how romance is like the best pill and cheese to get anyone involved in any, like, to take difficult ideas, like put the pill in romance. And so to couch things in romanticity and fantastical tales, in love stories. And so for me to say, like, we've been bad lovers, but the world is giving us flowers and sensual experiences and bird songs and places to put our bodies. And like, even when we've been horrible, like, can we listen to that again? Can we accept these courtship entities? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you would think even if people can't see it in the world, they would at least see it in each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh my God, just walk down the street and there's just like lovers. These are all potential lovers, and they're all over the place. And how long it must have taken to get us
so
alienated.
That's what I mean. Have you read or had on the show? I don't think you have. Luke Kemp, who wrote Against.
I did.
Black. You did. Okay.
I did. Yeah. I've been obsessed with him lately.
Me too. His thinking is really, I think, some of my favorite on this whole continuum of like, how did we get here? The question I've been asking recently is, how did we lose our counter-dominant strategies? Or like this instinct to walk away when it gets bad, to play with these new ideas, to play with civilization, and then to say, this is not super great. Let's leave the city. Like, it seems from his case studies that for most of human history, we were pretty good at walking away when it got bad. And we are not so good at walking away these days. And I'm curious about that. Yeah.
Right. I know. Somehow, you know, this thing of democracy sort of replaced walking away.
Yeah.
You know, and we're so sedentary.
I mean,
good luck with that.
And de-skilled. Now, I mean, yeah.
And de-skilled.
We can't make our own medicine. We can't grow our own food, make our own houses. It's crazy.
Right. I mean, in some ways, there's the good because we're symbiotic and we have civilization and we specialized and all that. But I mean, to the point where, I mean, this sounds so boomer or something, and I'm supposed to be a buster, so I'm supposed to be a Gen Xer. But when I was in high school, we had an auto mechanic shop that we took, me and the other main nerd kind of wanted to, partly just to get to know the jocks and the greasers, we both took auto mechanics at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was such a good class. Oh my God, you learn how to fix cars. And now you can't do that. You can't have auto mech in a high school because it's just like replacing computers in proprietary, you know, things. That's happened to us throughout our civilization.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot, I mean, I'm always also writing about feminism and I think a lot about how one of the most dangerous things for a woman is to lose their skills within a relationship. Like, a man is making the money, he has the accounts, he knows how things work, he knows he has the car, everything's in his name. Then it's a lot harder to leave. Like, in abuse situations, it's a de-skilling process. And it can happen really slowly. Like, oh, I'll do that for you. Let me do that for you. You can quit your job. And I feel like that's what we've had, like, with Big Daddy civilization. And now we're at the point where we're like, wow, how am I going to get out? Can I take the cat with me? Like, yeah.
I know. And Big Daddy thinks he's being good.
Yeah.
He thinks, oh, my God, you don't have to work. You can just plant or do art or whatever you want.
Right?
But yeah, it doesn't quite work like that. Yeah,
no.
Unless we both don't. We could both not work.
I know. I know.
Both not have bank accounts, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, something I've been thinking a lot about that, again, your work helps me with, particularly the new one, is the kind of the be here now element of it. You know, you're not looking for curing this disease. It's not about the fix. And it's so hard for people to get that. I'm really into serenity prayer lately. I just did a talk with Mitch Horowitz, new book, it's about the left-handed path. And he's saying, you know, the serenity, he has a whole chapter on why he hates the serenity prayer. Because of this whole idea of accepting, the balance of accepting things, that you should be pushing everything towards what you can change. And I guess, for me, it started with the Bufo being willing to just die. It's okay, just die. Just accept dissolution as part of this whole thing. We're all dying all the time in some way because we're being influenced. It's all okay. Be as porous as you want and realize that your distinctness itself is somewhat of an illusion, right? I'm the number of microbes and things. So that got me to the kind of a kind of anarchism where even as a political philosophy, where it's not about, oh, I'm a communist with a theory of change, but a real anarchist, all it's really about is, am I being kind in the moment to everyone around me right now and trusting that that will fractal out to
exactly
what's yeah. right.
And that's also fairy tale logic, which is just like, you're no, really, I think fairy tales are brilliant. I think there's a reason okay. why these things are hardy. It's just like, you saving that little caterpillar in the first act is what will save you in the final act. I mean, for me, I had this moment, which is in early COVID, I was having these really intense encounters with woodchucks of all varieties. And I was really hung up on what it meant for me, like how important it was to me and my path and my life and what they were teaching me. And, you know, I was like doing research about Lenape woodchuck legends in the Hudson Valley and woodchuck culture. They're matriarchal. They are very clean. And I was thinking about woodchucks a lot. And then I was driving home along the road in the middle of this like weird spring hailstorm. And there was on a highway and there was a woodchuck just stranded on the median line. And it couldn't go either way without getting hit. And I didn't think I had been primed to notice woodchucks. So it was like all of this accumulated woodchuck energy to throw the car into park on a highway, in the middle of the highway, jump out of the car, put my arms out like this. And the woodchuck jumped into my hands. And wild animals don't typically do that. It was like, and I just ran across the highway and put it on the side, like into the woods, and it ran off. And this woman is screaming at me. She's like, lady, you look crazy. Like, you know. And I had to get rabies shots. I had to get like 20 shots because I had a cut on my hand and it kissed my hand. Whole thing. But that experience for me it was like a rupture. It was like, oh, I thought this woodchuck is here for me. My whole life was about trying to get me in place so that I could save that woodchuck. That woodchuck is the main character. I'm not the main character. We're so good at imagining that these moments in our life are about us and our personal development. But why we're here may be some very strange moment like that, where, I don't know if listeners will have seen Game of Thrones with the Hodor moment, but like, this character's right. name, you think it means something, but it's this moment where he saves another character. His whole being is about this one experience of saving another character.
Right. And I mean, that's the beauty of the sort of, in fairy tales like Game of Thrones, they can create a temporal loop
yeah,
so that you can see it.
But you can't yeah. see it in your own life. But the woodchuck helped me to kind of feel like, oh yeah, all these woodchuck encounters were not maybe about me. They were about this one woodchuck.
We're having such fun in this talk and embracing life and surrendering to the swirl and all that. And I know at least half my listeners look at the way we're talking as a kind of spiritual bypass.
Yeah. Right? And I know, and I think, I mean, as someone who I'm very allergic to spiritual bypassing, so I want to be careful that like, yeah, this is fun. But this is not doing anything.
Right. And yeah. that's why the application of what we're saying for me is, you know, I was part of, and I wrote about this friend of mine who died who kind of made me even more part of it. I felt like I was part of this frontal war against the polycrisis and capitalism and stupidity and authoritarianism, you know, which is kind of using the empire's or the master's tools of might makes right.
Yeah.
Against the master's house. And you're really looking at how nature heals a ruined landscape through things like, you know, these pioneer species like weeds and fungi that kind of crack through and allow stuff. Is the sort of embracing, you know, pioneer species and modeling pioneer species kind of a fledgling theory of change that you're pointing towards for us?
I think I have to also say that I have less and less hope that human beings are going to be the architects of the next chapter of whatever comes, that what our job is right now is probably to have as least harmful an effect as possible. So it's less about solving and more about like, how can I minimize the harm I am producing right now in small practical ways and on larger ways? One thing I've been thinking about a lot are serotonin seeds. So seeds that only open like the table lodgepole pines after extreme fire. And they're part of natural fire cycles in forests. And when forests become too dominated by these tall trees that shadow everything out so that there can't be different plants in the undergrowth and biodiversity actually starts to tank, there's usually some kind of fire. And all of the pines or these tall trees will die. They'll burn up. And in that process, it releases the seed pods that melt and then repopulate again and only open up under duress of fire. Mm. And for me, it's been a really intense metaphor I've been sitting with like a koan of, I actually don't know if there's going to be like a clear pass off of the baton of us and whatever comes next. I think there might be a lot of fire. Oh, I wish I had a better pat answer for you about what we can do right now. I really think it's as practical as like growing food in your backyard, learning one practical skill that will make you useful to your community. Like maybe that is herbalism, how to treat UTIs without antibiotics. Mm. Like, no, like this is a simple and like very practical thing. Like learn what are the actual edible plants in your area that sustainably grow? Like that's, have your one skill. I also think we have this idea that we need to learn everything. We need to fix it all. Become useful to one place in one way. I think that actually has a remarkable ability to change how we live. Yeah. So for me, it's like I'm like the disabled, glitchy. I'm going to die in first wave of apocalyptic violence. I won't have my EpiPens. The bee's going to sting me and I'm going to die. Like, I'm not in any way naive about what's to come. Like, I am dependent on all of these things. But if I do survive, I would like to have one practical way of keeping the people around me alive. And so for me, that's herbalism and plant information, like really like learning a literacy of how to read the plants in the Hudson Valley and Woodstock where I live, which ones grow where, like that's practical knowledge. So ecological literacy, I think, is what I would say, like know the plants in your area, protect them, protect people from developing them. That's the most important thing.
Right. Yeah. And any basic skill, you know, it's like, and the basic skills we learn are just terrific things to learn in order to understand how reality works. Yeah. Whether you're learning, you know, first aid or being a birth doula or a death doula or any of the kinds of, just think about, if there was nothing, what would people need? I know how to get eggs from chickens. I know how to take care of the chicken. Simple thing. You know, do you know how to irrigate? If that, make irrigation your thing. You understand how to do biodiesel and to get engines to take it? Do that. You know, it's almost like any test. You know how to just do latrine management, but really well, you'll be a friggin' lifesaver.
That's the thing, is it's simple and it's not sexy. I mean, the thing I've been really interested in where I live is we have all the infrastructure for these water dams and rivers and to convert electricity from our local waterways. And if we wanted to keep electricity up and running for a while, we have the old infrastructure to do it. Is there a way we can think about how to bring that back?
Yeah, there was this guy, he did this series of novels. He got a little right wing in the end.
I know
the
you're
talking
about.
Hand, Winsler, world Made by Hand novels.
Yeah.
So, you know, in spite of bizarre misogyny in those books, you know, he basically imagines this world. We've returned to our natural world, handmade stuff and misogyny, but you can do it without the misogyny. But the making candles and how to repair your house, and it was a really in some ways beautiful look at how easy it would be if people knew how to do stuff.
I mean, the one thing, so So there's that, which is definitely very Little House on the Prairie fun. And I loved reenactment when I was little. And then there's the more complicated, scary work. And we're going to need these people too. And I've been thinking about this a lot. There's a great TV show, Paradise. Did you see it?
Yeah, they based it in part on my book, Survival of the Richest.
No money, but they told me. My God. But they have a team of people going to shut down the nuclear plants. And I was like, that's what we need. We need teams of people who are, when I was watching Chernobyl, I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is my issue. Like, I've been like thinking about this is like, we are going, no one is thinking about when things collapse, we have all of these nuclear plants that are going to melt down. Like, we need to train people to go in and shut these things down.
It's not even that though. And even that, it's a beautiful image. We're going to go and shut them down.
I know.
But, and that's, I'm saying but, not and, which I'm always supposed to say and, but this is actually a but.
Yeah.
There's spent fuel rods in those places that have to be kept cool. And the only way we know how to keep them cool is to run friggin' water on them, you know, to use, we need electricity to keep those things cool. So I don't even know, even if you had a great team of 20 people in every county to go turn these things off, I'm not sure where I guess we bring those things to the ocean or something and let them go in there.
It is really haunting me. It has become the new thing that I'm just really is keeping me up at night is we do not know what we've unleashed with this.
Right. But then, you know, that the only way out is through. So that what we need to do is, you know, compelling narratives for the way to solve this sort of cascade of technological crisis is with more technology.
Yeah.
More nukes, you know, that, and I do get it, you know, maybe we do need at this point, just like, you know, you or my daughter might need the biologics or whatever to keep going from one, you know, month to the next. We need Monsanto to go create fake seeds that grow alfalfa on cement with no rain, you know.
I think about drunks again, which is there's always some excuse to keep going. And whenever I hear about the technological solution to the technological problem, I'm just here drunk talking. It's like, yeah, you want to keep drinking. There's always your drinking is so bad, you have to keep drinking. There's no bottom below the bottom, though. Like, I know plenty of addicts that have died. Most of the addicts I know have died. Like, they don't, and a lot of the conversations about those addicts have been like this, which is you just have to let them go until they hit rock bottom. Well, rock bottom is death.
Right.
So most people, you know, and do we want to see how bad we can, how many atrocities we can create? Do we want to see how evil we can become? Is that an interesting thought experiment? I don't know.
Right. And it feels like it's never too soon to get things right.
Yeah. Like,
you know,
come on. But you did point to something, which is I have to hold my own individual survival as being apart from the greater aliveness of this world. Like, I personally may be dependent on air conditioning and medical intervention and medical research. But I am in relationship and covenant with the biosphere, not my species. I am a species traitor. You know, that's what I always want to say is like, I would rather pledge allegiance to the unfolding creativity of this biosphere than to just me. And I just have to, it's kind of what comes back to your revelations with the Bufo. It's like, if this means that I'm going to die earlier because I don't pledge allegiance to techno-optimism and that course, I just have to be okay with it. And that is a point where acceptance isn't this passive place. It's actually profoundly active, you know, where you're like, you know, I'm going to accept that actually this could be really painful and hard, but I think I'm going to do it.
You don't even have to go to that place where I always go. It's like, well, it's not my fault that I'm dependent on this because my problem itself is the result of microplastics.
Yeah, I know.
Because it's it's an easy justification. It's like, well, it did it to me. So now I've got to, you know, but It also, it can be thought, if we're collective, this is a appropriate marshalling of resources, and the way we collectively, you know, slouch back toward or forward towards.
Yeah, forward or back, I don't know. I mean, you had Eric Wargo on recently, right? I do think about, like, what messages are we receiving from our future selves? Like, what warnings right now? I one thing I was thinking about that would be really interesting is to do, like, a giant dream study to figure out what people are dreaming right now and to see what archetypes are coming up, like, to try and figure out what is emerging to people at this very, very intense moment. I wanted to do... I had this idea of creating this website, like, call it, like, Dreaming the Apocalypse, where people would, like, upload their, like, nightmares they've had. And then I thought it might be a bad thing.
Right.
And then I thought, like, no, maybe you don't want to bring that into being. You don't want to, like, archive that. But I am curious right now, like, what, you know, not that it's a slouching backwards, but maybe we are being pulled into a different shape. Maybe we are stumbling forward into something weird. That's why I'm not completely rejecting AI. I'm kind of looking at it out of my side eye, like, okay.
Right. And even if it comes from, you know, the dudes who are furthest along this sword, you know, yeah, sky god thing, that could be the point from which it circles back around.
Yeah. I don't know.
They don't know. I don't know. And that's why, you know, and I read, you know, Vanessa Machado de Oliveira,
yeah,
and some of the other folks who are thinking, even Tyson Yunkaporta is kind of, yeah, like, hey, it's kind of interesting. You know, the people who feel a little bit less guilty, less part of dominator culture, are looking at it in ways of saying, no, this actually, y'all might have created something interesting here. You know, so I'm accepting the sort of indigenous take on this.
I think something I have been thinking is, I think people's fear of AI is actually their covert fear of themselves. And I think when people are afraid, right, of AI, it's what they're really saying is, I think human beings are the utmost evil and AI is humans. And I think it's like a shadow. We are afraid of ourselves and we have created this. And
right,
I think that Tyson and Vanessa are saying, actually, the saving grace is that this would not be human.
Mm-hmm.
It would be something that would be like a trickster and totally outside of our way of operating.
Right. And then, and could be then an interesting partner. You know,
maybe. I don't, yeah, know. I mean, I've read enough dystopia and sci-fi to feel like it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, and its current impact is so bad,
yeah,
that it's hard to justify. Again,
that's
the ends justify,
yeah,
the means, you know.
The amount of water and energy and pollution, the material aspect of it to me is the most, I don't know, the most sinful.
Yeah. I mean, because it's and that's, again, back to your work and my work. It's like, if you're not doing it in the moment, then you're not doing it. You know, we disregard the actual moment that we're in at our own and everybody's peril.
Peril,
you
know?
Yeah. And what your work, among other things, what your work adds to the equation is, you know, and the moment that you're in is not always free of pain. You know, that's,
yeah,
part of it too, you know?
Yeah. We have forgotten that suffering is part of life and that, you know, in a very simplistic, my dad is an ex-Buddhist monk. He ran New York Zendo for a while. He, you know, so I was raised with a lot of like Buddhist monks around, you know, to escape samsara is to definitely stay in samsara, you know, to try and escape suffering is to amplify suffering. Like on a very rudimentary level, like we have to get better at suffering. Like we have to be okay with it. When we try and escape it, we produce it in every other being around us.
Right.
It's pretty actually, dark. But.
No, it's dark, but it's beautiful. I think that's actually a good place to end our first Team Human conversation. You know, let people sit. Let's sit with that and all of us, because you can that thought, you metabolize that thought, and it's what gets you to nirvana, too. you know?
Maybe. I cannot report that I will say, I always think of Groundhog Day as being like the great metaphor. Like, which day of Groundhog Day are you on? Like, I'm still stepping in the puddle. I'm like way early.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for what you, people who don't know Sophie Strand, I know we just jumped into it. There's Flowering Wand, The Body is a Doorway. Start with those two. And then if you just want some interesting fun, read The Madonna Secret,
yeah,
which is an actual novel. Are you working on more now? Or are you always working on something?
I have a book of poetry coming out in March next year, Make Me Good Soil. I'm finishing a book on romantic ecology. And I have two sci-fi series, so sci-fi fantasy series that are in the submission process. So this has been really, really wonderful. Thank you, Douglas.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. And thank you all for being on Team Human. You can support this thing, please do, by going to patreon.com/teamhuman and supporting at any level. You get all sorts of stuff. Most important, you get the ad-free team feed. You can get access to the Discord channel. And most important, you get to be a participating metabolizer of this thing with us. And if you can't, that's fine. Steve, please come. Please watch. That's metabolizing too. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.